Hello, and welcome to the Sports and Communications Podcast with Jim and Isaac. Today's show features discussions about the recent U.S. Women's National Team equal pay court case and how each sports league is handling the COVID-19 crisis, as well as a special interview with crisis communications and litigation expert Jim Haggerty. Now, let's get to the show.
All right, so first I want to talk this week, JR, about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and their ongoing lawsuit. As many of you know, it's been covered in the media a lot. They filed a gender discrimination lawsuit in March against the U.S. Soccer Federation about fair pay. And since then, it has really bubbled up into a major issue. One of the only issues that's being covered right now that has nothing to do with coronavirus. I know that you've been following this since the beginning. You've been reading all the documents in the court case. Can you give us a little backgrounder on where we are today and why this week it's bubbled up yet again?
Yeah, this is definitely one of the more interesting sports PR blunders since the Houston Astros scandal, I would assume. So just a quick background, as you mentioned, the women's national soccer team, as most people know, is the best women's soccer team in the world. They're dominant. They're the two-time defending women's World Cup champions. And after they won last year in 2019 at the World Cup, attention turned towards the equal pay argument. Now, obviously, that's something that's gone on in women's sports for at least 50 years in this country, but this is the latest chapter. What makes this a little bit different than the days of, say, Billie Jean King is that right now, the women's team is markedly better than the men's team. People don't even follow soccer that closely, I think, realize that. So they're in a unique position that I don't know if any of the other women who have fought for equal pay in the past have been in. So this being the case, they kind of already had, I would think, public sentiment behind them in that people recognized how good they are and what they bring to the sport in the United States. So now an interesting twist happens. The U.S. Soccer Federation comes up with their court filing, basically revealing what their argument is going to be against equal pay.
This is the one that came out on March 8th.
Yeah, exactly. This is the initial thing that was a public court filing. So, everyone had access to see it. And of course, journalists picked up on it right away. They proceeded to come up with the most boneheaded, tone-deaf argument that you could possibly imagine for claiming that women shouldn't be paid the same amount as men, which was that, well, the men's game is tougher, it requires more skill, more strength, literally the complete opposite of what a professional PR person would advise that they argue. And by the way, it was largely unnecessary because as proven later on, the judge actually, to the surprise of, I think, everyone, dismissed that notion and said they can't go to court with that. And they're just, going to proceed with the trial on other minor issues like travel related things.
Which is crazy because a summary judgment you would only get a summary judgment if the judge in question says, I don't see any way that a jury could find you guilty of this.
Right.
Which at its best take is a far-fetched idea in this case. The second I saw that, I was like, I don't know. It's like they didn't read the documents.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. So here's the funny thing. They get this olive branch, just like, complete luck, it seems. The U.S. Soccer Federation, that is, get this thing handed to them where they find out, like, hey, we don't have to worry about that now. You know what? We screwed up, but now the case isn't going to go to trial, so we're good. But that's not the case, because they didn't have the right structure at the onset. What happened was they sent the wrong message, the wrong tone. All public sentiment went towards the women's team, and they couldn't even benefit now from the fact, or take a victory lap, so to speak, by the fact that this was thrown out. They're still at a disadvantage. That's how much their communication error messed them up going forward. So now they're in this weird situation where they might be in need of trying to settle, and I kind of put air quotes around settle, with the women's national team, even though they more or less won. Because, you know, before the next collective bargaining agreement comes out, this will all be worked out. They're going to have to figure out a way to appease the women, even though, you know, a judge has said, listen, it's not the case that the women weren't paid as much as the men. These are the decisions they made. They had a chance to have a similar deal to the men, but that wasn't the case. They actually chose to get more sure money up front and less incentives. And even still, they wound up making more money than the men. But yet you would think the shoe's on the other foot. They're now going to have to like reach out to the women, I think, and kind of work something out with them so that they don't get destroyed or continue to get destroyed in the court of public opinion.
Well, I think you raised a really good point, because their whole messaging campaign has been around equal pay, that it's 2020. It's what, 60 years after Title IX. This is a joke that we're still talking about this. I assume that the women are significantly more profitable than the men, forgetting what they're paid for a while. I mean, the men weren't in the World Cup and the women won the World Cup. They're certainly more popular, but it's not about equal pay. It's about the CBA that they signed. And I think that's what makes this so interesting, is that they've successfully reframed this as equal pay. And it shows a real alarming dichotomy that I see every day when I'm working with lawyers. You said that no PR professional would write this. I think even more than that, nobody would write this if they were ever thinking that it would be seen in public. When you hire lawyers and you don't bring them in and you don't work with your communications team on every single communication strategy, by being so laser focused with your blinders on about the court of law, they completely forgot the court of public opinion, that they knew that this was in social media. And you get this a lot, where somebody will buckle down and say, I'm just going to focus on the facts. Well, that's convenient for you, but if nobody else is just focusing on the facts, that's how you blow it. And they blew it because the judge sided with them. They have a very good case. And not only did they alienate any form of public support or any for even a negotiation ploy, right? Like, how can we get leverage to come to an agreement, to come to a settlement, either within the case or in the next CBA, which will happen before we get a final decision on this case? Instead of that, they alienated everybody. And so they won, but they can't say we were right because they've already lost. What should have been celebrated as a really big win, and I'm putting in quotation marks because this is not the end of the case, but what should have been as a major opinion in their favor, that they could have trotted around and sort of put out this fire a little bit, saying we're going to come to an agreement, but the law is on our side. They can't do that because everybody is so convinced that they don't want equal pay. And this is one of the most egregious things I have ever seen from a public-facing federation that knows that the case will be fought in the public. It's pathetic.
Yeah, this is one to keep an eye on. It's sort of a story that just keeps on giving, and I'm sure it's going to keep on giving for a long time.
This actually is a great transition. Our guest today, Jim Haggerty, who in 2003 wrote the book In the Court of Public Opinion that really put him on the national stage as a communication strategist. His whole argument in the book, and we'll get into this in the interview, is that the court of law and the court of public opinion are very different from each other. And you see here that the U.S. Soccer Federation's lawyers are fighting in the court of law, and they're making legal arguments that we know work in a legal framework, but we know that taken outside of that really come off poorly, to the point where they've lost the case before a judge hit the gavel.
Joining us today is Jim Haggerty, president and CEO of the crisis communications firm PRCG Haggerty LLC. Jim is an attorney, author, and consultant with more than 25 years of experience in crisis communication. Jim's landmark book, In the Court of Public Opinion, is currently in its third edition and has been referred to by the Financial Times as the perfect handbook for this age. Jim's latest book, Chief Crisis Officer, Structure and Leadership for Effective Communications Response, was released in 2017 and has been positively featured in the Harvard Business Review, Fortune, and Entrepreneur Magazine, among others. In 2019, Jim's agency launched a new sports vertical, appropriately named PRCG Sports. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've covered a lot of ground, obviously, over the course of your distinguished career, and about a year and a half ago, you actually decided to expand your footprint in the world of sports communications, and that's where we'd like to start today. How does someone who's carved out this very impressive career as one of the foremost authorities in litigation and crisis communication suddenly find himself thrust into the complex world of sports communications?
Well, it's interesting. I started out thinking about it because I'm a big sports fan and began to get involved more and more in the marketing of golf companies through client relationships I knew. And it seemed to lend itself to developing the special sports division. What I hadn't really been thinking about at the time, but became very clear to me very quickly, is that the sports pages are very much the crisis pages these days. What you find is that even before the whole coronavirus situation, you had crisis and legal stories dominating the sports headlines for months and months and months, whether it's issues with the Olympic teams, USA soccer, problems with the Houston Astros, what have you, the NBA's problems in China. Over and over again, sports news and crisis news were the same thing. And so in retrospect, it seems like a natural.
You mentioned the Houston Astros. They were certainly at the forefront of a huge PR blunder. A little bit more recently, the U.S. Soccer Federation has had some issues with the way they presented their argument in the equal pay case. Do you have any general advice that you would offer to these entities about how they should proceed, in the future in similar circumstances?
First of all, and I see this happening with clients of all types, in the initial stages, they seem to be making it up as they go along. And I often put it in a sports context that you wouldn't send your team out into the field and only then begin making up the plays. But that's what you see time and time again when problems occur in the sports world or really any industry. And so in the Houston Astros case, I mean, they had two significant crisis issues, one on top of the other, at least two. I mean, I might have lost count there. And each time it was a fumbled initial response followed by the response or statement to clarify what they had meant or something along those lines. And that's always a great sign that they really don't have their act together. And that's what makes an event into a crisis in many cases. I mean, you see the same sort of thing across the sports field. And, one of the reasons is a lot of these sports teams, they're small businesses. And even the leagues are small businesses, almost mom and pop operations. And they just don't have the skills, the preparation, or the planning to respond effectively to a lot of crises, which you can sort of see coming.
Jim, how does a crisis agency work? Do people come to you after the crisis, mostly to do some mop-up work, or do they come to you when they see something on the horizon?
Well, most of the time it is, unfortunately, after the crisis has hit, the first reporter has called, the lawsuit's been filed, and everyone's scrambling around figuring out what to do, and they're doing Google searches, and our firm's name comes up. We've always encouraged companies and organizations of all sizes to plan beforehand for these crises. In fact, my book, Chief Crisis Officer, deals with just that, how to put the proper structure and leadership in place beforehand so you're ready to go when a situation hits. But by and large, no matter the size of the organization, and even the most successful sports teams, franchises, universities, leagues, they're basically scrambling. Even if it's something that they should have known was coming, they're scrambling. And inevitably, the result of asking someone who knows us or a Google search, they find our way. And it's amazing how quickly we have to jump into events and crises because the client's in the midst of it when we get involved.
So that's a perfect transition. I mean, with the coronavirus, it seems that everybody is scrambling right now to respond. From your vantage point in weighing crisis communications, what have you been seeing in the sports world?
Well, it's the same thing. And I think that people want to know, no matter the crisis or issue, they want to know that you're on it. They don't think you have all the answers, but they want to know that you're doing your best to figure out what's going on, what's going to happen next, and what you're going to do about it. What you see with sports teams and leagues, and part of it, you can't blame them. It's the unprecedented nature of the crisis. But a lot of running in this direction, then running in that direction. You see it in Major League Baseball, which has been a big problem, is first we're going to put everyone in Arizona and play all the games there. You hear that. Then everybody objects to that. They apparently forgot to inform the players before word of that leaked out. Now we're going to do something different. And it's this inconsistency of response that that you see in teams and leagues and others, events that tend to make people's heads spin. And I think the better alternative sometimes is just to say, we're on it. We don't know exactly what we're going to do about it, but we're going to find a way through this. And I think the more you can do that, the more effective you can be.
So, Jim, you actually just led perfectly into my next question. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how the four major sports leagues in the United States, at least, are going to deal with the resumption of play or the start of a new season amid the pandemic. Baseball, as you noted, has floated maybe inadvertently, maybe purposely, a number of different scenarios. And you certainly mentioned the downside to that. Is there a positive to it, though? Is it a case where it's good to purposely float some potential plans just to see how the public would react?
Well, I think if you do it right, maybe. I think a lot of times they've been floating these things out there like as if they're trade rumors, you know, where it leaks out with one reporter that someone happened to be speaking to, or there's a memo that gets disclosed. I mean, if a sports league, let's use Major League Baseball, they went out and said, here's the situation we're facing. You know, there are a number of options we consider. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We'd like to find out which would be most appropriate to the fans. We'd like to figure out which is most accessible. We're going to be doing that over the next several weeks. Then you'd have this sense that, wow, there's an organization that is on top of this. And even though they don't have the answers right now, they're going to involve me, the fan, and they're going to find those answers. And I think that that's been missing from some of the stuff.
Jim, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's very interesting contrasting this with the private sector, where for so long it's been accepted that an organization is going to solely do what benefits the shareholders. And in sports, specifically with leagues and teams, I think there's different considerations. Do you think that it's more important for teams and front offices to be speaking to fans right now, or to be speaking to brands and partners?
I think both are important, but I think ultimately that your fans are always number one. You always have to work backwards from the ultimate consumers of your product or service and figure out how to put them at ease so that they remain, in this case, they remain fans. I think that the problem with a sport like baseball is not that they can't figure out a way to start the season, it's that they can't figure out a way to start the season and make money. And I think from a fan's perspective, that the second part of that, they don't care about. They don't care about if the teams are making money. They want to hear about how you're going to get games being played, because that's going to make me a loyal fan from this year into the next. And you run the risk of losing a whole generation of fans if all you're focused on is, well, I need to have a certain level of revenues going through the end of this season. I mean, it's not the case that, I mean, I'll give you an example from 9/11, when games started up again, there was a real question as to whether fans were going to show up. But the owners and the league didn't say, well, let's not restart the games because we don't know who's going to show up. They said, you know what? It's good for the sport and it's good for this country to restart the games, and we're going to do it. And I think that the short-sightedness you see is a result of this notion that I'm not going to do anything unless I'm still making money out of it. And I think that kind of attitude has changed.
Yeah, that's coming to play a little bit with, you know, losing money at the gate if you're spacing people out, things of that nature. So that's one way that I think this differs a little bit from 9/11, but the point's still well taken. How would you comment on the NFL? I think the way they've handled their draft and the announcement of the new schedule, which is about to take place, has been pretty interesting, because they largely received positive reviews for the virtual draft. And it wasn't that long before they committed to doing it that they received a little bit of flack for maybe being callous or insensitive. But obviously got a huge rating. People were happy to see it. And they've consequently made this a big production of their announcement of the schedule, which, by the way, is on time. And I think as of yet, I haven't really seen too many people complaining that they plan on starting on time. What was your sense of how that all went down?
Well, the funny thing is the NFL, they handle a lot very poorly, right? I never expect Roger Goodell to do anything smart. In this case, they did, and I think they were really smart about it, and they didn't listen to one of the things we find in crises across the board is the chatter in this social media age can make you do a lot of wrong, stupid things. And I think that you have to know what to listen to and what to ignore. So if there's an eruption of chatter against the NFL because Joe from Queens doesn't like what the NFL is doing, there has what I try to tell clients to do is understand the real signal from the noise and try to focus on the signal so you know what you're doing. I mean, the NFL did it very well, and they also altered, if I remember correctly, they originally envisioned the NFL draft to be a show like any other. And as things began to develop, they began to change they weren't afraid of changing their plans as they went along in an uncertain environment. And they wound up with a very humble draft that was among the highest watched programs in sports in recent time, right? If I'm quoting, and that's because they had this sense of what they were going to do and that it would be altered without checking Twitter every 5 minutes to see how things are being perceived. And sometimes you got to do that. You got to turn off the static in the background, the noise, and just focus on what you're trying to signal.
Jim, as a trusted advisor, you kind of laid out a really neat example and juxtaposition between three major leagues. The NBA, Adam Silver said, I won't have any decision until the end of April at the earliest. Don't bother asking me until then. The MLB has been pretty transparently floating trial balloons throughout April. And the NFL is going on as if their schedule is not going to change and it was any other year, even though we all know that they'll probably make changes to that going forward. When you're talking to your clients, who do you point out as the best example to follow? Is there any harm in pivoting like the NFL may have to do compared to what the NBA is doing and saying, wait until we come back with an answer? We're thinking about every option.
I'm biased towards the NBA and the way Adam Silver handles things because I think he's a genius. And I can be, since this is a sports podcast, I can be opinionated about these things. I mean, I think that it was fascinating the way the shutdown of the NBA was a unilateral decision that focused the nation on this whole issue in the first place, or who knows where we'd be. It's the equivalent of Pearl Harbor. Commissioner Landis alerting the nation to Pearl Harbor after the bombing. I mean, it really was something that I've never seen sports take such a prominent lead role. And I think that he's right in delaying the issues. I mean, particularly because unlike baseball or even football, basketball is a contact sport in very tight quarters in jerseys. There's a lot of bare skin rubbing up against bare skin and people breathing on each other. Whereas you can put a helmet with a shield on it for the NFL, you're not going to start helmeting and putting masks on NBA players. So they have a special kind of problem. And also it's a very tight arena, right, where everyone's breathing on each other. So I think that in my order, I would say NBA has handled it really well. NFL gets most improved because they've handled it far better than I ever expected. And then Major League Baseball has just been making me insane. I'll tell you something else. I watched the Korean League play yesterday, which I know nothing about and was learning about as I was watching part of one of the games. And the fascinating thing is, I think, I don't have confirmation of this, I think they were piping in the sounds of a crowd, like the murmur of a crowd in the games. And for someone watching at home, it didn't seem all that different than a baseball game. You know, it was fascinating to learn. I love the way people play baseball in other leagues, and particularly the way in Korea and Japan they slap at the ball more than swing for the fences. I just find that fascinating. I find the fact that they're corporately owned, some of the teams, to be fascinating, and they have the Samsung logos and ads on the helmets. I find that fascinating. But what I found most fascinating was the fact that when you put the ambient sound in there, it really did seem like regular baseball, and it didn't matter who was in the stands. And it leads me to the question of why can't we do that here in the U.S. and get leagues started up again? You know, I'll tell you something else, that having played MLB and the show, you know, over and over again as video games, you can create a situation where it seems awfully real, you know, particularly for the television viewer. And yet it's this, and baseball's in a difficult situation because so much of each team's revenues comes from people in the stands. And let's face it, the New York Mets can't afford to lose revenues at the moment by putting on a show.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there's something else I wanted to touch on with the NBA situation that I think speaks to how important reputation is, which is, of course, what this business is all about. So not to take away from the way Adam Silver handled the NBA shutdown, because you're right, it was monumental and it was very noteworthy. But I think he maybe inadvertently, was able to rely on his reputation as the most astute league commissioner, because let's face it, what really was the impetus for that shutdown was Rudy Gobert contracting the coronavirus, being the first athlete in the four major sports to be diagnosed with it. It sort of forced the hand. However, because Adam Silver is such a well-regarded commissioner, I think he benefited from that. No one said, oh, sure, Adam Silver was an easy decision for him because one of their players was sick. If he had been a different commissioner, I won't name any other names, he might have not gotten the benefit of the doubt. But how do you feel his reputation played into the way that whole thing was handled?
Well, so we have a concept called the credibility bank. And it's the idea that everything you do in the lead up to a crisis or during a crisis either adds or subtracts from your balance in the credibility bank. And Adam Silver had an awfully high balance in the credibility bank. So when he pulled the plug on the NBA, everybody stood up and took notice. You know, if Jeff Wilpon had been the commissioner of baseball at the time, or the commissioner of the NBA at the time, and decided to shut things down, everyone would have looked at it and said, whoa, what is that sleazy dude up to?
I take it you're a Met fan, Jim.
I am a Met fan, and I'm hoping that someone buys them. But the point is, if you have that balance in the credibility bank, what you do has such resonance that you're almost given not a pass, but you've earned the reputation. And I think that if you look at the NFL and Roger Goodell, he had an awful reputation. And I think that if it were, Adam Silver were the commissioner in the NFL, they'd be, throwing roses in front of his feet as he walked down the street for the way that it's been handled.
I'll tell you this. I mean, I have a photo in my office of Branch Rickey, the longtime famous Dodgers GM. It says, luck is the product of design. And I was talking to a guy in the NBA PR team last week, and he was saying that they had already planned out, even though on a national level, we weren't taking coronavirus seriously until that second week in March. They had already figured out that the second any player tested positive, they were going to cancel the season until further notice. And that's how they were able to do it within 2 hours. You know, he was telling me that they had about 45 minutes from when the league found out till when the country found out, when the game didn't start at 7:05.
Yeah, and this is the problem I faced for 25 years in crisis communications for both, sports teams and other sorts of things, and for other corporations and organizations, is you're in the conference room, you discuss it with people, they go, yes, yes, that's what we should be doing. We're definitely going to do that, Jim. That's a great idea. And then you leave, and everyone goes back to what else they were doing in the course of the day, and it's forgotten. And then the crisis hits and they say, boy, no one could have anticipated that. And it's the rare organization these days that sits down and says, OK, let's stop the daily social media feed and think about what exactly is going on and what's going to happen next. Because the public wants to know what's happening, what's going to happen next, and what are you going to do about it? And that ultimately, they'll accept mistakes along the way, so long as you're communicating that you're on top of the situation. I think that the planning that the NBA did is why it went so well in their case. Because if it had been someone else, it would have been the third quarter of that game before anybody made a decision about anything, because you would have had 39 people trying to decide what to do at the same time.
So taking that, looking forward, let's look into your crystal ball a little bit. What issues do you foresee tripping up different leagues as we slowly but surely, and hopefully I might add, return to regular sports on TV? I don't know if that means there's fans in the stands or not. Where can you, as somebody who's been around this for 25 years, point to and say this will trip up people who are not prepared?
Well, it's a fascinating thing about crisis these days, in that it's not just the plant exploding that's the crisis now. It's the very running of your business that's the crisis. And so in sports leagues, they have to apply some of the principles of crisis communications to everything that they're doing going forward, because it is in that context of being able, who's the strong leader? Who's leading the crisis? Who's making the decisions? Who's that core committee that's making the decisions on how to move forward? I mean, I've been in crisis situations where the crisis is happening in real time, and I walk into the conference room and there's 27 people sitting around a conference table, you know, having a discussion about what to do, as if it's a college classroom. You know, meanwhile, I'm looking at my watch saying, wow, you know what, the Wall Street Journal is on the line. Somebody better make a decision somewhere about something. Do you have that structure in place for the resumption and for all the issues that are going to happen in the resumption? Or is it going to be an academic seminar each step of the way and you're not going to be able to communicate properly with your audience? I mean, I think more specifically, you can have baseball games without fans. I think we're beginning to see that. You can do it, right? I mean, I think that outdoor stadiums have an advantage over indoor stadiums. You could sit fans 6 seats apart, or families 6 seats apart in Giant Stadium in New York. I mean, you could temporarily remove the seats from stadiums to keep people apart. I mean, all of these things can be done to get the games going again, but I think that the focus is not necessarily, am I going to lose money, but am I going to make less money by actually having to put on a show? I think that's the problem that all the leagues are going to have to face. And, you know, this crisis happened so fast, and I heard this yesterday. It happened so fast. And actually, I heard this in relation to real estate prices and what people are asking for, both commercial properties and residential. The drop came so quickly that the asking price is still the price of 2 months ago. And so if you look at sports leagues and teams, they still think it's January or December, and they're going to find a way, once this quote unquote pause is over, to start making money like January or February. That's not going to happen. They have to figure out how to slowly build back up both their audiences and their revenues going forward.
Yeah, you make a lot of good points there, Jim. One last thing we wanted to ask you today, as leagues return, and yes, logistically, it's certainly possible for baseball, as used as an example, to separate fans and just bite the bullet on lost revenue and not come off as being, you know, money grabbing. But how would you advise a league, or actually, I guess, really more so a team president or a GM who has to walk the line? Because let's face it, there's some people in society who are obviously sort of fed up and saying enough. You know, we have to get back to normal, and there's other people who are being a lot more cautious. Do they risk alienating one side or the other if they take a hard line on, you know, removing seats from a stadium, or forcing masks to be worn,
or taking tests away from medical professionals?
Yeah, or taking tests as you walk in. You know, do they face a risk of being on one side proactive and wonderful, and on the other side being overly cautious to the point where fans feel unnecessary or rejected?
I think that there, you're never going to, the other thing I've learned in the crisis communications field and in the work we do is you're never going to please everybody. There's always going to be this, let's call it hard left and hard right group of folks who will be angry at everything. And in the sports world, there are people who desperately, almost psychologically want everything to go back to exactly the same way it was and come what may. And so everybody just let's put 50,000 fans back in Citi Field. And listen, if 10,000 of them died, they shouldn't have been at the baseball game anyway. It's their own fault. That's the extreme view. The other extreme view is nothing can go forward no matter the psychological implications or the economic implications until we ensure that not a single person dies at any point in our future. Neither of those things, those are extreme positions on either side. I think the bulk of the folks are in the middle. And whether it's removing seats, putting tape over seats, otherwise easing back into sporting events or any events. I mean, again, indoor versus outdoor is a big part of this. I think you can't have Broadway shows, you know, but you can have concerts in the park. They're properly spaced. I mean, all of those things are going to figure into our return from normal. But I think you will never, what I've learned is you'll never make everybody happy. And there's a certain percentage of folks you just have to ignore as you go forward because they tend to take extreme positions and nothing you do is going to satisfy them. You know, if you put 50,000 people in Citi Field, but you're going to take each temperature, you know, Joe from Queens is going to be calling sports radio to complain about that. This is just the world we live in. The question is, how do you ignore that sort of stuff?
All right, to close up, we're going to put you on the spot here. Make one prediction in the next couple of months in the sports world that's going to make a lot of noise, make a lot of ripples, but to you shows that it's smart people thinking methodically.
I think that the NFL is going to wind up having a pretty good season. And I think that they're going to have different types of equipment, different procedures on the sidelines, fewer people in the stands. And I don't know the economics of it compared to other sports, how important the gate is versus TV revenues. But I think you're going to see that football is the thing that brings us back to feeling normal.
Jim Haggerty is the president and CEO of PRCG. Haggerty, LLC, and PRCG Sports. Good luck to your Mets, sir, and thank you for being with us.
Great. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jim. Take care.
You know, recently, as everybody's been talking about more realistic plans for the NBA to start up, you've seen the NBA, and this is no surprise with Adam Silver, the only league that is floating as test balloons, reasons why they wouldn't start up. And what I'm specifically referencing is Brian Windhorst had a report, and make no mistake, that's clearly coming from the league, that they weren't going to start up a season again until there were a million tests conducted daily. Why? Because everybody can be rooting for the NBA to come back up because we're all bored every night, and at 7:05 when there's no sports, we don't know what to do with ourselves. But even if you had 16 playoff teams only playing in a bubble, using, I think they said they needed 50,000 tests for that to happen. What happens when somebody writes a front page article saying those 50,000 tests should not be used on athletes every single day to make sure that they can play against each other? It should be used for first responders. It should be used for the elderly. We can't afford those 50,000 tests. And the NFL is pretty good about pushing forward and saying football will be back. To a degree, some colleges are saying, oh, somehow, some way, Saturdays will be back. Baseball will be back. The NBA, frankly, the one that can start up the soonest, is the only one saying, to me at least, we're weighing our options here because our fans know that it's not just about ticket revenue. It's not just about how much money we're bringing in. But we're very aware of the optics. We know the great potential it's there, right? 7 million people weekly are watching Michael Jordan, who last played 20 years ago. We saw what the NFL drafted. We know what the NBA finals would do in a dead TV economy. But we're considering everything. And the fact that they're floating that out, to me, shows that when they return, they'll have thought about everything. Because what happens if a player gets coronavirus? Do you shut everything down? What happens if a player dies or a player's mother dies? How are you going to deal with that? I'm not confident that baseball has thought that far ahead, even though they seem to be putting themselves in the same timeline as the NBA.
Yeah, and that underscores to me, everything you just said points out the major difference between completing a season that was in the you know the back end of it and starting up a whole new season. That it's really a huge difference. I mean, sure, the safety precautions are the same issue, but you know, baseball is sitting here thinking about how can we start and what kind of a season can we put together because it's all in front of us. Whereas basketball is saying it's largely behind us. How can we complete it? Can we get away with not completing it? They could at least mull that, you know. So I think they could afford to be a little bit more cautious because they got a good portion of their season in, whereas baseball is in a whole different situation. So I think they have a different set of challenges, even though they're dealing with the same pandemic.
Name one thing you like and one thing you don't like that they've done as a communications professional. I'll take the NBA. I like what they did about mentioning tests already and setting a goal so that they have an excuse not to play when everybody feels like they can, about a million tests. But I'll also say that I really am frustrated with this report this week that came out with the Athletic, Shams Charania, that starting Monday, teams are allowed to talk to their season ticket holders about their plans. And from what I looked, I saw four or five teams already put out statements. Maybe more did, and I just haven't come across them in the media. But I think it's ridiculous and unlike what I would expect from Adam Silver to not have every team already have a plan in place and release that all in the same time, rather than saying, okay, now you can go forward and some teams wait. You saw the same thing, right? I believe now, I'm almost positive, that all owners are now covering their hourly employees for missed games. But it took about 2.5 weeks of public shaming for everybody to get on board across all the major sports. And based on that experience, I'm very surprised the NBA took the same route with how they handle season ticket holders.
The character that may be better to talk about a good and a bad thing might actually be the NFL as opposed to Major League Baseball, because the NFL has at least garnered some attention with the virtual draft. So, I mean, the positive, I guess, is that they held this draft successfully. It was wildly popular. They raised money. There was a charitable aspect to it. They managed to not seem to infuriate anybody who may have been opposed to them. I mean, they took flack at first, like for saying we're holding our draft on the regular, because I think they held on the day they always intended on holding it. They circumnavigated that. They did okay with, you know, the way they went about it. So that's like a plus.
Yeah.
The negatives, I'd have to think a little bit about what's the most negative of what they've done. I mean, you know, I thought it was a little, although they seem to have gotten away with it, I thought there was going to be more blowback in this. I thought it was a little odd that when they announced the 3-hour special, which in and of itself I have a little problem with, but that's another story.
Yeah, I saw a great tweet where it was, when I see the schedule, it's like I glance for my bye week.
Yeah.
When we play our division rivals.
Right.
And Sunday night games. And that takes all about 40 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was definitely over the top. But what's interesting is that they're not pushing back at all. There was a lot of talk at first about pushing back the start of the regular season and pushing back the Super Bowl. And aside from getting rid of bye weeks and international play, it seems like they're largely going to have the same exact schedule. And I thought people were going to cop onto that and say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. You know, you guys are putting together this nice fluffy special and going off the good vibes from the draft, the virtual draft, but you're not making any concessions.
Well, I'll tell you what they did. We're recording this about 6-7 hours before it's released. I saw a report that what they did, and this is honestly a term rarely used with the NFL, brilliant, is that they put interconference games as the first 4 weeks so that if they have to eliminate those, those are the least consequential games when it comes to deciding a division. And so, for instance, the Patriots are playing the NFC West for the first 4 weeks of the year. And if those 4 weeks have to be canceled or have to be suspended, and we have to end up playing a 14-week season, divisions won't be impacted.
I mean, I wouldn't not give them credit for that, but hey, that's what they get paid for. They should be able to figure that out. It's not that complicated, but it's a good call, absolutely.
And it's interesting that they're not promoting all these safety hatches that they're building into the schedule. You know, they're putting a very, and this might go towards that they have a significantly more conservative fan base than the NBA. But they're not saying we're concerned about a September 1 start, even though they're clearly working behind the scenes to make sure they can afford an October 1 start. And they're projecting in the most brazen way possible. And I think it's working.
But all right, so that raises another good point, and this is a on point with communication. So if you're really hedging your bet and you're saying we're going to start up on September 10th as planned, we're just going to figure out other ways so we don't have to move back, we don't have to push back the Super Bowl. But you know that full well there's a more than decent chance you may have to push that back. It begs the question, why then do you do a three-hour special on your network?
Oh, that's easy.
I get it. I know exactly what you're going to say. But like, to me, don't crow about that and make it an even bigger deal if you know darn well that you may have to push it back. Because if I watch that, I want to believe that you really are going to start on September 10th.
But that's what they want their fans to believe. And I think that they're doing a pretty good job, right? You talked about it earlier. There's a very big difference between finishing a season and starting. The NFL can come out looking pretty good in this if they crow and peacock about how we fully expect week one to be fantastic. And then they decide in October, in the interest of safety, we have to postpone the season. Right? They've had all this goodwill throughout the summer of people looking forward to football starting again. They have had an incredibly successful draft. They've had what I have to assume is going to be an incredibly successful, and I hope not a sign of things to come, but I'm not confident in that, 3-hour schedule drop. They've been the one dictating the news when there's no other sports news. And then they say, in the interest of safety, we're taking safety first. The first time the NFL has ever taken safety first, when they inevitably say on August 1st, the season won't start in a month.
Yeah, I guess it could go either way. I mean, I tend to think you're probably right in that they'll get some positive publicity where people say,
baseball is going to be screwed because if they've already floated this out enough, if they don't get a feasible solution to July 1st or August 1st, after saying, oh no, we think we're going to get somewhere, right? This is what Jim was talking about, right? By saying, oh, we'll probably get there. We're very confident we'll get there with some special solution that will fall out of the sky. When they don't,
yeah,
the story is Manfred couldn't figure it out. When the reality is, nobody could figure it out.
Yeah. And again, each sport's a little bit different. And I by no means mean this as a defense of baseball as opposed to football, but we're talking about them each starting up their next season. But again, there's a huge time difference here in that baseball was meant to start at the end of March at the height of the pandemic. Football is not meant to start until September. And
right. Then football has more leeway.
Well, yeah, but then throw in the fact that football has 16 games, you know, for each team. Baseball has 162. So they're up against a whole different ball of wax of condensing a very lengthy season, the lengthiest season. So it's a whole different set of challenges in that regard as well. But listen, getting back to your point too about, you know, the way it'll be perceived, I do think, yes, a lot of people will give the NFL credit. And then other people, cynics probably like me, will just look back and say, I wish they wouldn't have like been so emphatic back in, May, you know, announcing the schedule. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, I think they've done a lot of good things. I actually do applaud them for waiting to when they did wait to make the announcement that they intend on starting on time. I think it was a little bit premature when people were yelling and screaming saying, this needs to be decided now, or when people just were deciding things way too early. I think it's actually good that they waited till when they did to kind of make the announcement that they made. It was probably better off and didn't need to be made prior to that, despite what people may have been saying.
I think it's really interesting in light of the looming CBA fight between the players and Major League Baseball, that they do seem to be on board together. Obviously, you have some players like Trevor Bauer talking out, but that's par for the course. But I think that the MLB bought itself some goodwill by very quickly acquiescing to counting this year, whatever form it takes, as an arbitration year. And I think that the players are keeping things close to their vest in terms of what they're willing to give up, what they're willing to use as leverage in this much larger fight that they're all getting ready for down the road. I can guarantee you that whatever this season looks like, both sides will be pointing to what they agreed to as leverage for those larger arguments.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you just saw this week with Tony Clark, you know, sort of piping up and saying, oh, hey, by the way, we haven't gotten anything, you know, like, when are they going to share this with us? We read about it just like the general public, but we haven't been asked to vote on anything. And sure enough, the very next day after that story breaks, you know, sources say that, oh, don't worry, we're going to get it to you in a week. You know, the check is in the mail. Because they had to. So I think Tony Clark was smart to kind of use the media to his advantage in that regard by putting that out there, because it kind of forced a source from MLB to say, oh, yeah, no, we're working on it. We're going to have it for you in a week. And it gave a time frame. Because understandably, I think Tony Clark was like, hey, I don't want people to think this is on us. We're not dragging our feet. It's the league. You know, the players are just salivating, waiting for a plan they could vote yay or nay on. So let them get it to us and let the public know that it's them, not us.
Yeah, I don't know where the players have been doing it already, right? I think once we hear, the players are rightfully waiting. Their strategy is, let's hear what MLB actually has to say, not just what they float to Jeff Passan. Let's hear what Manfred proposes. Then we'll point out where we think we're suffering from that, right? Whether it be 4 months away from my family, whether it be now the league minimum is 200,000 if it's prorated, whatever. They'll pick their arguments, and the players are so much better than the league at fighting in the media that you'll see those brought up, hammered home again and again and again of what the players gave up. It's setting the grounds for a really interesting fight to take on a whole new twist.
Yeah, I tell you, that was going to be interesting if they had gone with that plan, because, and this is exactly why I think it was floated. I saw the few players that did comment. It was an interesting dichotomy, because some guys were like, listen, players got to play. I don't care what it is, I'm in, you know, and other guys were like, whoa, wait a second. You know, you're telling me I got to be away from my family and I can't do this and I can't do that. Like, if that plan had gotten put into a vote, I think it definitely would have been nip and tuck as far as whether it worked out or not. And I suppose in a way you could argue that that's not a bad thing, because then the next plan that's introduced after that, which is the one we'll probably see, I think everyone will be like, all right, fine. It's not perfect. It's not exactly what I wanted. It's not exactly the way they wanted it, but it's good enough. We can't keep discussing this. Let's just give it a thumbs up and we'll work out all the details.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the show. Come back next week for all the best takes on crises and communications in sports. Till then, stay safe and go Dodgers.